And welcome back. Many of you remember Farai Chadeya from the work she has done in the past with NPR as host of News and Notes. She is truly a hyphenate who wears hats as journalist, educator, lecturer, and author, and more. She has written 6 books, including her latest, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. She's currently a fellow at the Harvard Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy, exploring how the media covered the 2016 election. And she will be in St. Louis Monday to participate in UMSL's Martin Luther King Observance. Farai joins us by phone from Brooklyn, New York. So nice to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope your weather in Brooklyn is better than it is right here, where we're getting a lot of ice, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's actually pretty nice right now, I have to say.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Well, again, thank you for being with us. You know, given the work that you're doing on the election, and because that's so much of what most people are talking about these days, I just want to get kind of an overview impression from you as to where we are right now following the election and what's going on. What are you thinking at this juncture?
I mean, I always think about how people communicate with each other, and I've been spending some time communicating online with people who self-identify as white nationalists. It's I've kept an open line to that part of our society for a long time, and I think it's really important not to fall into the trap of normalizing everything, but it's also important as reporters that we talk to people who may have views that are part of the American fringe, because even if they're on the fringe, they're still important. So I think we have to challenge ourselves to figure out not just how to deal with what's going on in Washington, but also what's happening in people's communities and how people are talking to each other, and also more concrete things like do we have more hate crimes? Are we experiencing turmoil in our communities? And that's something we have to take a look at.
Do you think the media fell down during the last election cycle because it did not talk to enough people and really didn't have its finger on the pulse of the nation?
I think that was true in many cases. I think, first of all, you know, during the primary season, the primaries were covered pretty poorly in a lot of ways, just not giving people enough fact-based information on what different politicians' plans were and getting more involved in the psychodrama of the election and, you know, who was the son of a president and who had a reality TV show. So there was a lot of ground that the media had to make up, but I don't know that we did it particularly well. And so that's part of what I'm going to Harvard to study, is just looking at exactly what happened with the election coverage. And I do feel that people are profoundly disconnected from many parts of American media. And I do think public broadcasting is one of the places that is actually the best off in terms of credibility. A lot of different types of media have lost credibility, but I think that public radio and public television, relatively speaking, have done well.
How do you explain Donald Trump?
I mean, first of all, I look at international politics, and I've written for 538 quite a bit about the rise of the far-right parties in Europe. And there's definitely a global wave going on of looking at the world from a perspective of scarcity and fear of change. So this is not just an American thing, and it's not just Brexit. There's much more going on. You know, in the Philippines, you have an authoritarian, vulgar leader. In many parts of Europe that people are used to thinking of as political monocultures or ethnic monocultures, there's a lot of rise of the far right, whether it's Greece or Germany
France.
Austria. Yeah, France, certainly. Very powerful. So this is, we are part of a global moment in time, and I don't think that globalization is anything that you can put back in the bottle. I don't think that our government's policies have always been the best on it, but it's just, it is the state of being. And any American politics that proposes to sort of make us an island in terms of trade or in terms of immigration is just going to be a pause in inevitable demographic change. And I say that I certainly have strong feelings as the child of an immigrant, as well as the child of an American-born person. But aside from personal feelings, I just see that we are not, we in the U.S. and European far right, et cetera, who are against a melding of cultures, time is not on the side of that perspective. And I say that with all respect to people who have concerns. I have concerns about aspects of how globalization is happening, particularly in the world of employment, but it's just a fact. And so I worry that we are spending too much time trying to put our finger in the dike instead of trying to move ahead as a nation with permanent solutions.
This is really where media comes in and doing a job, a responsible job, and really not just covering the news day to day, the 24-hour news cycle, but really context and detail.
Yeah, and I do think that, for example, I spent a lot of time in Ohio talking to Trump voters concerned about trade and globalization, and I have a friend from college who was from the same area, and NAFTA did profoundly affect people in the Mahoning Valley in Ohio, you know, profound job losses. And we have to take that into account as we analyze where we are today. I mean, I don't think just because I think that globalization is inevitable doesn't mean that I think everyone has the same stake in the game or how it's been played from the U.S. government side. So there are many different factors here. Obviously, there's race and racism. There's questions about the fiscal impact of globalization, the cultural impact of globalization, automation. But behind all of it is do we try to collaborate on solutions or are we trying to turn back the clock? And I think that history doesn't particularly look kindly on movements that try to turn back the clock because it simply is impossible. You can revive aspects of the past, but you can't turn back the clock. And I think eventually people will wrap our brains around that.
Did you watch the Trump news conference the other day?
I actually didn't watch it, but what I did was I was on Twitter, so I saw people responding to it, and then I called up the live transcript because NPR was doing a transcript as it happened. So I had a very interesting, I mean, I was just watching the reaction and the text without watching it on television. And the level of horror from many different journalists was palpable, but I also felt like this was not something that I personally thought was unanticipated. I mean, I didn't expect him to run a traditional press conference, and the political media has to change its game, you know, to adapt. You know, there's a guy named Andrew Tyndall who does a lot of television analysis, and his advice was short, simple questions. Like just, you know, forget about your fancy questions. Just ask Mr. Trump some short, simple questions and note whether or not he answers. And don't try to get, you know, don't try to pack everything into one question. And many people have also made the point that the political press will have to be more collaborative. So if he won't answer one person, everyone should have some sense of journalistic solidarity and just say, Mr. President, we're all waiting for the answer to that question.
Do you have any concerns, Fry, about the potential for intimidation of the press? You know, I think the big boys and the big girls are not going to be intimidated, the Times, the Wall Street Journal, et cetera. But down the line, I wonder if there isn't the potential there for intimidating a large portion of the media.
I think there always is. I mean, things have just been heightened. But I think, for example, a lot of local press feel more pressure from local politicians and business owners. And it's the kind of thing where is what I print going to hurt my bottom line is a question. And with, as you point out, it's somewhat different for the big national organizations. But I do think that there was almost a hysteria towards the end of the election about the possibility of Mr. Trump winning. And if the press is going to be neutral, then that's one thing. If the press is going to take a stand, that's another. But I think, first of all, the press has to figure out, like, are we going to be neutral about Mr. Trump what does that mean? What are its downsides, its implications? What does neutrality even mean? Or are we going to point out, are we vigorously going to oppose, any obfuscation by the candidate and his incoming administration of questions of fact, questions of law? And that requires a different mindset. I mean, to be a sort of investigative opposition journalist is a different mindset than just sort of noting what happens. And I do think that there's a fork in the road for the American press. And I'm not going to, I think that there's room for organizations that do one or the other and some that do both. But sometimes you have to make a decision about how, if you're going to be more investigative, you're going to get less access to the Trump team. I don't think anyone's probably getting a lot of access, but as a news organization leader, you have to decide, am I willing to go without any significant access to the president for 4 years? If you are, then you can do a certain type of reporting, but if you want access, then you won't be able to do quite the same thing.
Well, what do you think? Is the press up to it? Up to the challenge?
Well, I have concerns about what the press even is. You know, some people are reading fake news and thinking it's real news. Some people are reading what's considered mainstream nonpartisan news. Others are only reading partisan news. So I think there will always be fantastic journalists. But I am a bit concerned about what people even think the political press is. And if people and publishers are not on the same page, that's a problem. You know, if a bunch of people stop paying attention because the press is doing really good investigations, that's still a problem. You can do great journalism, but if it's not reaching people, you've still got a problem. So I think that part of it is about audience cultivation and really thinking, how do I connect with my audience around some very tough issues that we're going to have to deal with? And if my audience doesn't always agree with me, that's fine. But if they stop listening or reading, that's a problem. And so that's something that newsrooms are going to have to deal with.
Tens of thousands of, hundreds of thousands of women the day after the Trump inauguration are going to be hitting the streets in Washington, D.C., cities all over the country, and many, many cities of the world, and demonstrating for women's rights and against some of the rhetoric that we heard during the political campaign. This is really taking a page out of Martin Luther King's book, it seems to me. Do you think there's a chance that even with large numbers that it's going to change anything?
I don't think it's about changing things. I mean, the sense that I get is that organizers, let me rephrase that. It's not about changing immediate policy or producing a short-term gain, from what I understand. I think the organizers want to have a moment of connection and solidarity. And in some ways, a lot of the organizing that's going on right now, whether it's, on the left or the right, is about sort of people gathering strength from each other. And a lot of this is really just about groups of people. There's going to be a bunch of people who support Mr. Trump, who are there for the inauguration, and they will be coordinating and, building their strength. And then the people coming to protest will be doing the same thing. So I think it's really more about having that empathetic connection to people who believe in something you believe in.
You're going to be here Monday for the Martin Luther King Day observance at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. What message are you bringing to St. Louis on that day?
I'm really going to talk about how everything that we're dealing with now is something that's been around. I mean, I've covered politics on and off for more than 20 years. And so I've covered NAFTA, I've covered, job losses due to trade. I've been on the U.S.-Mexico border with the Border Patrol, talked to undocumented immigrants. I mean, just this is all always going on, including the rise of white nationalism and white supremacists. It's just about paying attention. So I think a lot of what I'm going to be talking to people about is how to take a long view of where we are today, that this didn't start yesterday and it won't end tomorrow. And the main thing that you can do is pay attention to what's going on politically and economically and culturally. And I will offer people some ways that they can interact with what's going on, because I don't think I think a lot of the most powerful moments in American society happen on a local level. And I've seen people materially change their neighborhoods or their schools. And I think now is a good time when national politics is so fraught to both pay attention to national politics, but also focus locally and ask yourself, does your city or town have a problem with the rise of white nationalists and white supremacists? How would you even know that? Like asking yourself the question, how would you even find out what's going on, can be a very good question. Because I've constantly seen people in a state of shock over where our national discourse has gone. And I haven't felt that shock because it's part of my job to get out there and talk to people and get a sense of it. But there's other ways to do that. And I think it's just really important for us to stay in tune with each other in this society, including people you disagree with, possibly vehemently. And if it's just, I'm really going to urge people to find the better angels of their nature, but also not to check out of understanding where we are today, because we are going to have to come to a collective reckoning about what American democracy is. And, the civil rights era of the 1950s and 1960s was a direct result of challenges that were embedded in American democracy and our Constitution. You know, the challenges that required amendments to enfranchise Black Americans were planted with the seeds of the same Constitution, which then protects certain rights. So this has always been contested space. And sometimes it helps to just take a long view of the arc bending towards justice, but also a very strong pushback. And we can see a pushback on voting rights. We can see a pushback on the idea of political participation. When the North Carolina Republican Party posted a in a state with some serious challenges to, how people were being purged from the voter rolls in a way that was very much, you know, as one judge put it, it was like 1901. And being able to look at what's going on there, and the Republican Party actually applauded the decrease in Black voting rates. And that's just a sign of, I think, the political nastiness. It's not just about North Carolina, but it's asking yourselves questions like, do we celebrate when people turn out to vote, or do we view it purely as a partisan exercise and we're only happy when our side shows up to vote? These are questions that we can ask ourselves in communities that relate to, the legacy of Dr. King, the legacy of the civil rights era. But the civil rights era was rooted in the very founding of this country. And if we don't understand that, and we don't understand that we're now kind of circling back through the civil rights era in some very material ways, then this can all seem very baffling. But if we take a look at the arc of history, it makes a lot more sense.
I wonder what he would be saying were he alive today, Dr. King.
I'm sure he'd be a little annoyed and not completely surprised, to say the least. I mean, I think that someone like Dr. King, were he alive today, wouldn't be shocked by where we are, might be disappointed, but also would just say, let's get it together, people, and keep it moving. I'm lucky to have some friends who really played roles during the civil rights era. One of my friends is 95 years old, and she was very active during the civil rights era and traveled all around the country to organizing meetings. And she's not freaked out because she's seen this before, and she knows that our culture has the ability to right itself, but not without some serious introspection, without some people being organizers and some people being journalists and some people being teachers and most of us opening up a little bit to the fragility of American democracy. I mean, American democracy is like a garden. You can't let it get overgrown. We have to constantly tend the garden, pull up the weeds, and what some people think are flowers, other people think are weeds. So that's the essence of the political battle.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and I did want to ask you about your book, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. That's quite a mouthful. what are you getting at here?
Yeah, basically what I, there was a recent cover of The Economist that put it far more simply, and it showed a person going from boyhood to old age, learning a variety of tasks. And it said lifelong learning is the key to employment. And really what I'm talking about is the move away from the traditional 40 years at one company job, and to people going in and out of jobs and in and out of entire career fields more frequently. And what holds it together is having a spirit of lifelong learning and being willing to adapt to a world that is changing rapidly. And I think that that also cuts against some of the fear of our times. If you know that maybe you won't have your job for even 5 years, but that you can retrain yourself to move on, the world is a lot less fearful and just tense. I think that there are ways that we can make ourselves ready for today's economy and today's America, and that's really what I get into.
We just have 1 minute left, but I heard it put this way, and this is going back a few years, saying the average person at that time would change jobs maybe 6 times during a career. Now it's more likely to change careers 6 times during a working life.
That's absolutely right. And again, I think that my book is full of tips and tools, and it's very practical because we all want to feel secure.
Well, the name of that book, once again, is The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. And the author we've been hearing from is Farai Chidea. She's going to be in St. Louis on Monday and will be featured as a keynote speaker, I believe, at the UMSL ceremony honoring Dr. Martin Luther King on Martin Luther King Day. Thank you so much for being with us. I hope the weather is better for you when you come to St. Louis on Monday.
Yes, well, I hope it's better for everyone, and I'm looking forward to coming back. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Kim Oswalt, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. Arts and culture programming on St. Louis On the Air is funded in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.